Chapter 10. The bedrock level quarters were far less impressive than those on upper stories. The hallway walls were plasticrete, painted a neutral blue, and otherwise undecorated. The ceilings were low. The doors were flimsy-looking metal, with large package delivery slots beside them. There was a smell to this level, an inescapable odor of a chemical sanitizing agent, suggesting an attempt by management to combat the leakage of sewage or industrial runoff. As Mara was performing her check of the electronics on the door into the suspect quarters, Luke saw two beings, a Gamorrean and a human, leaving other sets of quarters. Both were clad in blue jumpsuits emblazoned with the Zorp House apartment tower logo. They barely glanced at the Jedi before heading off toward the turbo lifts. "Looks as though this floor is mostly quarters for building workers," Luke said. Mara nodded.
"Mostly or entirely. Which makes me wonder how Lumia got a place here. Did she forge an ID and records, which is certainly within her capabilities, or did she bribe the building manager, and it's just a little detail he's conveniently forgotten? Oh, here we go. Stand back."
She stepped away from the doorway, and though he felt no presence of danger, Luke did likewise. The door slid aside with a scraping noise, suggesting that it needed to be realigned on its rails. The Jedi waited a moment for traps to spring, then cautiously entered. This set of quarters wasn't a hovel, but it was primitive. The main room, 4 meters by 5, opened via a curtained doorway into a short hall. Doors there accessed 2 bedrooms, a kitchen with minimal facilities, and a refresher. The walls and ceiling were the same blue as the halls outside, and the floor was covered by a thin, springy, off-white pad, scuffed here and there, but clean. There was no furniture other than a sleep mat in one bedroom and a chair in the main room. Luke and Mara moved cautiously from room to room, inspecting every closet and cabinet, turning the chair over, unscrewing panels from walls to see if anything was hidden. In one bedroom closet were 2 Zorp House apartment tower jumpsuits in Lumia's size. Mara paused while looking through them. Luke saw her nostrils flare, and then she pulled the garments from the closet, tossed them to the floor, and leaned in to study the back of the closet.
"Something?" Luke asked.
"A hidden panel concealing a locking mechanism. I think the whole back of the closet is a doorway. You?"
The alert diode on the package delivery slot was disabled. Something was delivered since the last time she was here. A data card.
"Go ahead and run it. I'm going to be a minute or two here."
Luke slid the unlabeled card into his datapad and watched a password prompt and a couple of lines of analysis text pop up on his screen. "Encrypted," he said. "We'll need to run it on a computer with some decryption muscle." Mara's reply sounded like muttered swearing in Huttese. Luke didn't know whether she was reacting to his statement or to the persistent unwillingness of the lock she was working on to be opened. "And speaking of encryption," he continued, "while I was getting at the data card, I was forwarded a message by the Temple Comm system, an encrypted recording from Leia." Mara glanced back at him, her brows up.
"How is she?"
"So-so, I think. She didn't mention Jason shooting from the Anakin Solo and killing her bodyguards. She did mention that Han was getting back to normal from the blaster shot he sustained."
"Good."
"And she asked me to do something." In a few words, he outlined Leia's request about putting a word in Jason's ear regarding the errant venture. Mara turned her attention to the locking mechanism as she considered.
"Sounds like a good tactic. But if you do it, you'll be conspiring with an enemy of the GA. I know how you like to keep your nose clean."
Luke offered her a dismissive little sniff. "Han and Leia aren't enemies of the GA. They're suspects in an investigation. If they're ever captured and charged, they'll be cleared."
"That's true. Our justice system is particularly fair and rational these days.
Also, getting to the truth is always a good idea, no matter how it hurts. Besides, if you're ever strapped for credits, you can always turn me in for the reward. Mara turned again to smile at him.
Luke, you always know the right thing to say.
I do. She turned back and made one final adjustment to the locking mechanism.
Ah, here we go.
There was a faint rumble from the closet, and Mara abruptly bent over backward, flexible as a gymnast, catching her fall with one palm on the floor. A dart, if a meter-long shaft of polished durasteel could be termed a dart, flew from the closet, passing over her at waist level and burying itself in the wall opposite. Luke's tone was exactly what he'd used to order a meal he wasn't interested in eating. "Look out, a trap."
"Thank you."
Mara rose. The doorway in the back of the closet opened onto blackness and admitted warm air, pungent with the smells of Coruscant's undercity. Native and Yuuzhan Vong plant life, standing water, plascrete so old that it was going to powder in places, distant sewage. Luke and Mara lit glow rods and entered. The access led to a utilities and repair tunnel. The Jedi explored it for 30 meters in one direction, 20 in the other, just far enough to confirm that its connections to bigger, more traveled tunnels were blocked by new plascrete plugs that looked solid, but featured hatches cunningly textured to look like surrounding materials. "Her own private means into and out of the building," Luke said. "Chiefly as escape route, probably, since we know she didn't use it when she returned here after killing Master Lobi."
"But knowing that doesn't offer us anything."
Mara sounded annoyed.
"The data card had better give us something, or we visit the Nemoidian and get our money back."
Coruscant, Jedi Temple, Office of the Elemirar Task Force. Curiously, considering the rigid militarism of his background, Jag Fell ran his task force very informally, and there were times when Jaina was quite pleased with the fact. Such as now. The office Luke had assigned them was large enough for several desks, floor-to-ceiling displays, and other gear. There was even room for a speeder berth, had the office been equipped with a hatch to the outside, and Jag had filled it with exercise equipment. Today, both he and Zek were shirtless, doing chin-ups, while Jaina sat at a terminal and watched them surreptitiously. The competition, and it was a competition, though neither man would ever have admitted it, was surprisingly even. Zek could draw on the Force to boost his reserves of vitality, but he was taller and, though lean, heavier than Jag. It took him a trifle more effort to perform each chin-up, and he was still recovering from his wounds. Surgery, Bacta, Jedi healing techniques, and simple rest had worked wonders, leaving a broad, facing scar on his torso, the only visible evidence of his injury. But the damage was not entirely healed. Jag, shorter and more compact, was in better shape, his muscles more clearly defined, and though he could not call upon the Force, he could call upon the stubbornness for which his ancestors, the Fell and Antilles clans, were both known. Jag paused at the top of a chin-up.
"So, time has gone by and we've seen no sign of Alima. We've added our monitoring program to the security systems of the temple, the portions of the Senate building that would permit it, the building where the Skywalkers keep their civilian quarters, and other places where they are occasionally seen, and we haven't seen a single flag drop. Zek, we're doing this all wrong."
"We should be doing sit-ups instead." Jag scowled, then lowered himself and began another 10 repetitions.
"Jedi humor. No, that's not what I mean."
"He means," Jaina said, "that Uncle Luke isn't Alima's current target. Otherwise, she'd have been detected. Meaning that Mom's the target."
"Ah." Zek finished his set, then dropped to the floor and reached for a towel. "So we track your mother down." Jaina shook her head.
"If it were that easy, Alima would have done it already.
Jag, grunting his way through one more group of 10, which would put him, Jaina noted, exactly and deliberately 10 ahead of Zek, nodded, finished his set, and dropped to the floor.
We need to get the monitoring software installed in places where your parents might show up. Smugglers' havens, casinos, and trouble spots. Here, around the galaxy, even on Corellia.
He paused to consider that last possibility.
I wonder if Galactic Alliance intelligence could swing that.
A current from the vent on the far wall carried air to Jaina, and she wrinkled her nose.
It won't take intelligence to figure out where that smell comes from. You both need to head to the refresher for a Santa steam. Not to put it too delicately, you stink.
Jag looked at Zek and gestured toward the door.
After you.
No, after you.
I'm smaller, so I stink less. A logical calculation. After you.
Zek frowned, but obviously seeing no way to slide past Jag's stubbornness or superior rank, wrapped the towel around his neck and left. Jaina sighed to herself. Zek had declared that he was over her, but as he'd recovered, he had grown increasingly reluctant to leave her alone in Jag's company. He didn't need to bother. Jag clearly tolerated her only because it was his job. He had as much told her so the day Luke had assigned her to him. And yet, since the discomfort of their first couple of meetings, he had grown less icy, his words less punitive. She wondered if he had begun to forgive her for her role in costing him, well, everything. About the only things he still possessed were his body and his skills. Not that she hadn't always admired both. She stomped on that intrusive thought as though it were a bug in the kitchen. Things were finished with Zek except for friendship, partnership. Things were finished with Jag except for professional cooperation. And, she hoped, a respect that would someday overcome the resentment he felt. She was done with men. She was lucky in war, unlucky in love. And she was the sword of the Jedi. It might take her a lifetime to learn what that meant, what her destiny was, and she couldn't afford to lose her focus just because she was tempted to jump into another doomed love affair. She became aware that Jag was still standing, waiting.
Was there something else, Colonel?
Inwardly, she winced. Even to her own ears, her tone sounded dismissive, and she'd addressed him by the military rank that had been stripped from him, as if it had been her intent to rub salt into an injury. Jag flipped his towel across his neck, his action mimicking Zek's, and showed her a forced smile.
Colonel, I suppose not, Jedi Solo.
He turned and strode from the room. She rose to follow, then stopped herself. She hadn't meant to sting him. She had inherited her mother's sharp tongue, but lacked the diplomatic skills that Leia used to keep it in check when appropriate. But perhaps it was better this way. She needed to keep him at bay, but she didn't want to hurt him. She didn't know how to achieve both goals. She didn't even know whether she wanted to achieve both goals, or either. Sometimes she wanted to hurt him. Sometimes she didn't want to keep him at bay. Blast him for getting past her armor. Kaminor, President's Residence. The holotransmission was in the image of a woman, a beautiful woman, her features aristocratic and refined in the inbred Hapen fashion, almost to the point of anonymity.
She's a generic Hapen,
Fjor Rodan told himself, and the startling thought made him more suspicious of her.
Your war and intelligence ministers argue and delay,
the woman was saying. She shook her head in sad sympathy, sending her golden curls swaying.
Knowing that your fleet will be wiped out by the Galactic Alliance forces if they make a misstep, and that would be catastrophic. But delaying will also be disastrous. Corellia will fall soon, and then attacking would be suicide. Soon the GA will turn its attention to Commonore, to what it perceives as Corellia's treason, and you will fall too.
Rodan snorted.
You're clearly proficient at cutting through the layers of disinformation we surround ourselves with, to keep people like you from taking up too much of our time. But that doesn't make you correct in your assumptions. Yes, the government of Commonore has spoken out against Alliance aggression and for Corellian independence. That's not an act of war, as readying a fleet would be.
The unnamed woman gave him a slightly superior smile.
For a man, you've done a superb job of instituting on Commonore the kind of government you advocated for the New Republic. There are no loose turbo cannons like the Jedi Order rolling around on your decks. But the same caution that convinced you to keep the Jedi at bay could doom you now. Though I don't think it will. You're clever.
For a man,
he added mockingly.
For a man.
Her reply was straight-faced.
I'm going to do you two favors. I'm now transmitting a package of data I have obtained from my sources within the Galactic Alliance Guard. Favio?
The next voice belonged to someone not in the holocam view. Transmitting, mistress. Rodan forced himself not to grimace. He imagined the speaker as a hapen drone male, his body perfectly maintained through exercise regimens for the pleasure of the woman he called mistress, his mind stunted by the pampered life he led. The woman continued,
"These are the plans by which the GA will conquer Commonore, exactly 1 month after the fall of Corellia."
"I see,"
Rodan said, keeping his voice neutral.
"Your people will analyze them and confirm their authenticity," she continued, "establishing my authenticity. Then, in a few days, I will transmit you the time and movements of other fleets that will be moving on Corellia, fleets that by themselves perhaps cannot prevail, fleets that with the aid of Commonore must prevail."
"Thank you for your transmission, my lady," Rodan said.
She smiled. Her image winked out. Rodan checked his comm display to make sure that the transmission had been cut, and that the data package was intact and in his computer. Then he sat for long moments, still on the outside, vibrating on the inside. Much of what the woman had said was true, especially the part about his ministers dithering. If the woman also spoke truly about the conquest plans, Rodan had to act. His ministers had to act.
"VL-8,
he said. Instantly, his secretary droid was beside him.
"Yes, sir."
"Transmit that data file to the ministers of war and intelligence, plus to everyone on our top military analysis list. Encrypt it to top levels, and attach a note saying that it must be evaluated. Then set up a meeting for me and all those parties for midday tomorrow."
"Yes, sir."
Star System MZX-32905, near Bimiel. Lumia waited until her medical droid was set up beside her reclining chair. She was healing well. She should be fit to return to physical activities within a few days. She was still weak, though, and wanted care to be instantly available if this task caused her to collapse. She closed her eyes and let the dark side power that suffused the asteroid roll over her, through her. Then she began looking, through the Force, for a distant target, a mind she had touched many times and reshaped during those contacts, a mind she had made so familiar and distinct she could find it even halfway across the galaxy. It helped that she knew on what world the mind was to be found, but even so it was long, wearying minutes before she found it. To her inner eye, it was a distinctive yellow glow, surrounded by tiny gleaming sparks of red. Fewer sparks than before. The efforts of the enemy to diminish her influence had apparently been successful in part. But only in part. Lumia smiled. The enemy's techniques were nowhere near as effective as hers. She approached the mind until it filled her vision, and she planted herself there, making its location an anchor point for her consciousness. Now for the second phase of this elaborate Sith technique. She drew back from her target mind, seeking other mentalities in the area. And there they were, glows of various hues, none of them, sadly, decorated with the red sparks of her influence. She sampled each in turn. Most were awake, firm, more resolute than she could affect at this distance. Others were too fragmented. When she touched them, they tended to drift apart into smaller, incoherent glows, and she knew that these were the minds of the inmates, the patients. Then she found one that was firm, grounded, but not so resistant to her touch. Its owner was asleep. Lumia sampled it further, found it to be the mind of a Quarren female. Like a spectral parasite, she affixed herself to that mind, forging a connection, drawing energy out of it and the body that sustained it. She could not draw that energy into herself, though she badly needed sustenance now. She could feel her own body begin to shake from the strain. But she could and would put the energy to use. Finally, she flowed into the distant Quarren's mind, flowed out through its memory of its surroundings, and she could see. She hovered above the Quarren. The amphibious female was dressed in medical scrubs, and leaned across a desk, sleeping there. This was a small office, packed with and lit solely by computer displays. A window looked out over a facing wall of building fronts, and there were for once no traffic streams to be seen. A door, ajar, led into a brightly lit corridor. Lumia got to work. Into the woman's sleeping mind she whispered, "Open your eyes. Stand up. We have work to do, records to read, instructions to issue." And the Quarren rose, her eyes glazed, her face tentacles twitching. Minutes later, Lumia restored the Quarren to her desk and true sleep, then drifted from the chamber to find someone. A very useful someone. Galactic City, Coruscant. Veterans Mental Care Hospital. Matrick Klauskin, former commander of the Second Fleet's Corellian Task Force, but for the last several weeks a patient in this too-sympathetic prison, awoke. The small room he'd been given was, as always, dark and quiet, its few items of furniture reflecting white gleams from the city lights filtering in through the transparasteel viewport. Everything was as it should be. Or perhaps not. The door was open. He frowned. The door opened only when the doctors or nurses came for him, or when his caseworker from the Alliance's Naval Administration visited to reassure him that all was well. They hadn't forgotten him. But now the door was open, and no one was entering. He sat up, his sheet falling from his chest, and realized that someone was standing beside his bed. He looked up. It was Adela. Of course it was Adela. His treatment here was all about his wife. Now she smiled down at him, patient and loving as always. Tonight she wore a shimmering synth-silk gown of burgundy. She had lost weight, diminishing from the pretty but distinctly overweight woman she had been the last time he'd seen her, to a figure he could describe as pleasingly plump. The gray was gone from her hair, too, and he realized belatedly that she wasn't just slimmer. She was younger. She looked as she had a mere 5 or 10 years into their marriage.
"Hello, dear,"
he said.
"You realize you're dead."
Her smile broadened.
"Of course I'm dead. I've been dead for years. But it doesn't mean I don't exist."
"Well, that's the point, isn't it? The doctors all say that you don't, that your very existence rests only in my mind. But they say I'm getting better."
"I don't exist just in your mind. I exist in fact. Phantoms of the mind can't open a door and free you, can they?"
Klauskin looked again at the door. It remained resolutely open.
"That just means I'm dreaming again. It's really not open."
"It is, as you'll find out in a moment."
Her voice became urgent.
"Darling, you've been lied to. We've all been lied to. The Corellians have been in the right all along, and we've betrayed our own people by opposing them."
Klauskin frowned. He knew his thinking was muddled, but he couldn't see how he was harming his homeworld of Kamenor by opposing Corellia. True, Kamenor's government had offered words of encouragement to Corellia, but that was just politics at work. Adela continued,
"Kamenor and Bathawi are coming into the war on Corellia's side, and you, darling, have been imprisoned here and convinced that you're ill, just so the Alliance can keep you from helping our world."
Klauskin sighed. Truth was such a slippery concept these days that he found it hard to trust, even his dead wife.
"You're either here or not."
There was a little curiosity in Adela's voice.
"True."
"And I'm either a prisoner or a patient."
"True."
"And Kamenor and Bathawi are either in the war or not."
"True."
"I have to know the truth, and the truth is in what can be verified. I'm sorry, darling. I'm going to go through that open door and then wake myself up. If I don't wake up, then what you say is true."
"Don't apologize, Matrick. I know these are difficult times for you."
Klauskin rose. His bare feet were cold on the tile floor. He walked out through the door, looking up and down the corridor at the other doorways. They were all closed. Adela followed and joined him. Klauskin raised his hand to his lips and bit the webbing between his thumb and forefinger. It hurt. He kept the pressure on, biting deeper, and tasted blood. He held the bite until he couldn't stand the pain anymore. And finally, he let his arm swing to his side again. Weary, he said,
"I'm convinced."
"Good, because you have a lot to do. I'm going to lead you out of this prison. Outside, a friend will give you clothes, transportation, and documents."
Her expression turned to one of sympathy.
"You've been a hero of the Alliance for so long, but they turned against you, and it's time to be a hero of Kamenor again."
Star System MZX-32905, near Bimiel. Lumia gave Klauskin one last sweet kiss as he stood on the walkway outside the mental hospital. The shaking her real body was experiencing almost reflected itself in trembling in Adela's arms, but she maintained ruthless control. Then she let Adela fade away to nothingness. Her consciousness roared back into her own body. That's when the pain and weakness hit hard. She spasmed, sitting upright, and nearly rolled out of her reclining chair. She forced herself to lie down again. She lay there, her limbs twitching, even the artificial ones.
"My lady,
the medical droid asked. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Feebly, she waved fingers at him, trying to dissuade him from unnecessary conversation. This session had gone longer than most, and had been worse than most. It would take her longer to recover. She wondered what would have happened if she had continued it to the point of her own collapse. Would she have died? Or would she be trapped on Coruscant, in the phantasmal body of a long-dead military wife, forever hovering around a man she had deliberately driven crazy? She didn't know the answer, and it didn't matter. She had succeeded, and Klauskin would now dutifully go about accomplishing her plans. The Galactic Alliance had been so circumspect about covering up the details of Klauskin's mental breakdown. They thought they were being merciful, that if Klauskin was able to effect a recovery, he could someday resume command, even if a lesser one. His official record said only that he was on administrative leave, which could result from a physical injury or an urgent family problem. He still held his admiral's rank and command rating. And in not informing the fleet that Klauskin was dangerously delusional, they had doomed... had doomed... On that thought, she fell asleep. Drua, Moon of Almania, Drua Spaceport. Customs inspections, Ben decided, are very inconvenient. The transport ride to the outer rim system of Almania had been long and dull. Ben spent most of it reading Jedi texts on his datapad. Texts about his grandfather, Anakin Skywalker, he'd been given as preparation for the document he was supposed to write. Or sleeping. He interacted very little with his fellow passengers, preferring not to become memorable to them. Finally, the transport had landed on the heavily industrialized moon of Drua, with its high-security spaceport and its carefully regimented customs facility. Ben stood in the inspection line, his small pack and his belt pouch in hand, and prepared to enter the 20-meter-long sensor tube. There he would be scanned a dozen different ways, and at the end, his belongings would be laid out on a table and hand-inspected, with anything the sensors had flagged receiving special attention. There was no way his lightsaber would remain undetected if he carried it through the tube. The tube allowed access through a security wall that was 7 or 8 meters tall, and there was a 3-meter gap between the top of the wall and the drafty-looking shell of the ceiling. There were lots of glow rod pods up there on either side of the wall. Ben could bound to the top of the metal awning above the tube entrance and might be able, with a prodigious leap, to make the top of the wall. He could then run along the top of the tube, clear the wall on the far side, and run out into the non-secure portion of the customs building to vanish into the night. Assuming it was night out there, and the holocams all over the facility would record his face, and his image would be on every guard's datapad in an hour. That would be inconvenient. Then he thought about the Jedi Temple practice droid and its foam steel balls, and he knew what to do. He looked up and found a glow rod pod well behind him. He reached out through the Force to grab it. Yank it. It rocked a bit. Ben frowned. It was firmly rooted. He focused harder, putting all his intensity into his concentration. The pod snapped free of its mooring and crashed to the permacrete floor, its cluster of dozens of glow rods shattering and sending glass pieces skidding along the floor in every direction. As everyone looked, and one armed guard trotted over to see what had happened, Ben used the Force to send his lightsaber up to the ceiling. There, above the glow rods, it was barely visible. He caused it to slide across the ceiling until it came to rest above a pod on the far side of the wall, and then, with meticulous care, he lowered it until it nestled into the cluster of rods.
"You're holding up the line, stupid!"
The speaker was an elderly woman, as lean as though she were made up of just bone and rawhide, a disapproving look on her face. "Sorry," Ben said. He trotted forward into the tube.
Sorry doesn't mean anything. If you were sorry, you wouldn't have done it in the first place. Sorry. Now you're being insolent.
Sorry. Ben thought about using his powers to cause her to trip. A face full of permacrete might scrub the disapproval off her face. No, she was old, and she might really be hurt. On the other hand, it would teach her a lesson, and she could stand to be taught a lesson.
At the far end of the tube, he handed over his bag and pouch to the gray-uniformed inspection officer and waited, frowning over the question of the old woman. What would Jason do in this situation? Ben shook his head. The question didn't apply. No one would have spoken to Colonel Jason Solo that way, even before he was famous. Why not? Because he was tall and handsome? No, Luke wasn't tall, and was only as handsome as his scarred face let him be, and yet everyone treated him with respect. Luke and Jason commanded respect because everyone knew it was a bad idea to mess with them, from either their appearance or their history, which meant that Ben was out of luck, because he had neither fame nor formidable looks. The old woman fussed her way up behind Ben.
"You're a very nasty little boy," she said.
Ben glared up at her.
"I take it back." "You take what back?" "My apology. I apologized, but you didn't accept it. You just used it as an excuse to keep being rude. You have the manners of a bantha with digestion problems. If you had children, I hope they were raised by piranha beetles so they'd be nicer than you."
The woman loomed up over him, her face distorting with anger, and Ben saw in her mind her intent to slap some of what she considered courtesy into him. But he intensified his glare and added to it a little push with the force.
"Try it," he all but said. "See what I become."
A bit of grayness crept into her complexion, and she took an involuntary step back. She turned stiffly away from Ben, handing her bag to her inspections officer, and looked at everything but Ben, muttering to herself. Ben's inspections officer handed his bag back to him. He also offered a silent smile and a thumbs up. Surprised, Ben offered a shy smile in return. He turned and trotted toward the door out of the customs facility.
"There," he told himself. "That's how Jason would have done it if he were my age."
As he reached the door, he let his lightsaber drop into his hands, then moved out into the night air.